Hello, dear human. Welcome to another episode of Emerge. This time, my guest is Bonita Roy. Bonita is a founding principal of the Adelore Insight Center, a nonprofit adult learning center focused on practices that support emerging wisdom. She also teaches a master's program in consciousness studies at the Graduate Institute. And she also works in a very dedicated way in the arena of bringing open participation into the workplace. And you can read a lot of her writing on this on her Medium page, which is full of really interesting articles. And I'll link to that in the show notes. In this conversation, we have a very, as is typical for this podcast, kind of meta conversation about how to have conversations across paradigms, and in particular across different meta perspectives of, you know, life or philosophy or how to understand the world. And so we really take a look at things like the conversation between Ezra Klein and Sam Harris on the Sam Harris podcast, as well as conversations between people like Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris, and just try to sense into what is going on in those conversations, and how might we have conversations across very different ways of seeing the world that feel more productive and more useful and more interesting and more generative. I really enjoyed this conversation with Bonita Roy, and I hope that you do too. Please reach out and let me know how it impacted you, how it landed with you, or really anything else. I love hearing from people who are enjoying this podcast. So without further ado, please enjoy this episode of Emerge with Bonita Roy. All right. Hello, everybody on the internet, and welcome to another episode of Emerge. This time, I have with me Bonita Roy, and I met or encountered Bonita on the internet after I posted the Jordan Greenhall episode. Jordan was nice enough to post about the episode on his Facebook wall, and then Bonita made a really fascinating, or at least fascinating to me, comment about specifically the conversation that Jordan brought up between Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris, and pointing out some nuances and complexities and subtleties around what it looks like when these perspectives meet or fail to meet in conversation. And so I immediately reached out to her because this is the kind of conversation that, you know, I want to have in this space. And we got to talking about it. And in any case, that's sort of the context of this conversation, is a conversation about how to have conversations between perspectives. But maybe, Bonita, do you want to share a little bit about what brought you here?
Yeah, so I really enjoyed your interview with Jordan Greenhall, and it brought up something that came up in a symposium between a group of philosophers. On the one hand, critical realists following the philosophy of Roy Bhaskar. He's recently died, and integral theorists. And they had come together to really try to have a tough conversation. And I was invited in as an unaligned kind of meta referee. And at certain points in the process, they would look to, there was another meta referee, us, and ask our reflections. And in this fascinating process, I realized that that they both had a meta theory. So I'm going to have to step back now. So when people have two competing theories, you get a certain type of conflict. And usually the way theories get adjudicated is that one theory can hold the other, but the lower theory can't hold the higher theory. So Newtonian science can be seen by Einsteinian relativity, but Einsteinian relativity can't be seen within Newtonian science. So that's what adjudicates theories. Now, in this context, you had two groups with two different meta-theories. And what was fascinating is what I realized is that meta-theories can hold each other. So the critical realists could see integral theory as inside their theory. So it gave them confidence that theirs was the higher meta-theory. Because with theory, that's what gives you confidence. But the integral community, the thinkers, could see critical realism inside their theory from their paradigm. And it gave them confidence that theirs was the higher perspective. And so you have this constant tumbling over. And this is a big wow for people who had hopes about adjudicating these kinds of conversations through the move to a meta theory, because it was like, you know, people say a meta theory, you climb up to 30,000 feet and you can see everything. And I say, oh yeah. And then when you get there, you see there's, you know, 100,000 mountains that are 30,000 feet high. So this became kind of a crisis point in people who think about things like that.
And what happened next? I mean, I'm so curious, like what happened in response to the crisis?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So what happened was they created a super meta theory called, I think it's called Integral Critical Realism.
Oh, geez.
That, that included the integral theory, critical realism, and complex thought by Edgar Morin. So Wilbur Bashgar and Edgar Morin. But you see, now you have... this is so typical of the way the universe works. There's a move toward unity, right? And then there's a splitting out. And so it actually moved toward this three-pronged, it's not a meta-theory approach or something. Yeah, that's what the outcome of that was. It's not necessarily... what I agree with or think is the only way, but that was the outcome.
Right. Yeah. And that was what really like struck me in your response on Jordan's thread is, you know, you presented this problem of sort of competing meta views or meta perspectives. And then you said, you know, the only thing that can sort of adjudicate this kind of complexity is not another vertical move, i.e. I think not what it sounds like they tried to do, which is to create an even more meta theory,
right,
which merely escalates complexity, but instead you said we need to learn how to release complexity,
right?
Which, yeah, I'm curious, like what is that? What does that look like? How does that help us resolve this tension or work with this tension?
Yeah, so I think people who follow Jordan Greenhalgh's work can sense that he's doing a different kind of move, right? I mean, there are certain people that you can feel that. So he calls it deep code. I call it source code. We've both been working with this kind of thinking for a while. But I give you an easy example. And I'll just give you the example, and then we'll move toward the brain headache, the brain drain. So the example is when Ptolemy was alive, he was trying to solve this complex problem, and that is how could you predict the locations of the planets in the night sky at different times of the year? And it was pretty difficult at the time, difficult computation to solve, and especially the problem of retrograde, so that Mercury, for example, at certain times looked like it was going backwards in the sky. And he came up with an ingenious system of epicycles, so cycles within cycles. And that was, robust because it had great explanatory power. It could actually predict all the locations at all times of the year. But then Copernicus comes along and says, why don't we just look at the problem from the center of the sun? The sun is a center. And it reduced all that complexity. So I use the term released the complexity, because the richness of the universe, it wasn't a reductive move. It was able to handle all that complexity, to get the simplexity, people call it, from an initially a complex situation, right? So, so it's kind of funny, because in this sense, people actually change where they were looking from in terms of how they had their mental model of the solar system. And this is actually a direct analogy for what I teach, and it's called a critical reflexive attitude. Where are you coming from when you're doing thinking? Where are you? So that's kind of the move. It's not deconstruction like the postmodernists do, and it's not a vertical move. It's something else. It's something else. So, yeah.
And so one phrase that came to mind as you were describing that is this idea I've been hearing a lot recently of the simplicity that lives on the other side of complexity,
right?
Which I find to be a very beautiful and kind of inspirational phrase, particularly when we're looking at praxis, like how do we actually implement some of these theories? And there's also this other piece where maybe we want to move now, which is, you know, so we have this different way forward. What did you call it again? Explanatory?
Bashgall calls it an explanatory critique. And we could talk about that. Did you have a question in there or?
Well, yeah, I'm always with this project kind of oscillating between a pretty high level perspective and then making it super relevant to like, you know, what's going on in our world right now, because shit is fucked up. You know, the world is in a lot of ways in many crises. And if the conversation isn't about that, then I think there's a problem. And so I want to take a moment perhaps, and we can again oscillate in and out of that space, to just say like, you know, from your perspective, why is this conversation relevant to the state of the world and our cultures and the conversations we're having?
Yeah. So what we're seeing now in a lot of these podcasts is a certain structure. And that is, there's some people on the one side of the equation that are actually reductionists. They're reducing the complexity. And I would argue that Sam Harris is one of them. We can get into some examples. And then on the other side, we have people that seem to be doing this other thing, this other move that's truly does not reduce the complexity of the situation, but the mind that is thinking is somehow thinking in a different way. In the middle is we have the postmodernists. So the postmodernists, they're asking questions around, should society regulate science, or should society adjudicate what is good science? You hear that in Klein, when Harris and Klein were, that podcast you sent me. Klein is interested in individual motivation and social consequences of ideas. Harris is interested in good science, right? So, what's interesting is that, that the people, the reductionists, can sound like the people who are postmodern, the people that are making this other kind of move, because they'll advocate for the same kinds of things like free speech, whether that's provocative or not. But the reductionists are not sophisticated thinkers, they're reductionists. And somehow we need to really be able to talk and look at What is rigorous thought today? What is rigorous thought today? Because we are starting to unveil the limitations of postmodern thought, postmodernist thought, and we're in the danger zone of sliding back into a reductionist critique, not something that's beyond that. So that's why I think why it matters.
And would you kind of put Jordan Peterson in that same category of attempting to reduce a reductionist?
No, I think he's a more sophisticated thinker. I actually think he's very much similar to postmodernist thinker. A postmodernist thinker is trying to...
He wouldn't like you to say that.
Yeah. No, I know, because I'm not talking about their values. I'm talking about the way his mind is constructed.
Their tactics.
Corrected. Yeah. It's a developmental level. So he tries to interweave ideas and instinct and values, and he does this all, you know, as the complex thing it is. So he can say, on the one hand, if I was standing in front of a transgendered person, I would use, for courtesy, I would use their pronoun, but I don't want it legislated. See, that's a complex package of ideas. Whereas Harris just wants to know if it's good science. And there's a critique around that he is his blind spot.
Interesting. Okay. So there are kind of now, or maybe is there any other kind of, like, before we look into both the kind of Sam Harris, Jordan Peterson relationship a little bit more closely and the Ezra Klein, Sam Harris conversation, is there any kind of theoretical groundwork that you feel like would be really helpful before we set out on that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that what I'd like to talk about is first this question of how does a modern society adjudicate or evaluate whether it's good science? And this is something that's been well researched. And that is, we can look at it, for example, we can look at it two ways. A science needs to be both robust and rigorous. There is a critique of empiricism. Harris is really interested in empirical science. And what does that mean? I can go out and test, in terms of what they were talking about, Murray's science on IQ and race, and I could see that the statistics is correct and the pool of participants was large enough and certain other parameters that makes it robust empiricism. So that's one measure, but is it rigorous enough? And so there's a lot more demand placed on science in as what's being studied gets more and more complex. And there's nothing as complex as human culture and intelligence, then it needs to be more and more rigorous. So, for example, it's kind of silly, really, because Harris says that Murray controlled for social and economic status, right? you can't control for social and economic status in a racist society because their social status is already different, right? So this is not rigorous at all. Just that one thing is not rigorous at all. And the other thing is, like, race is a construction. So if people have a little bit of white, you know, pigmentation or white in their heredity, then is Murray's kind of sliding scale for intelligence depending upon how much pigmentation is in the person's skin? So Murray's research is not rigorous. It doesn't pass the test, the demands that this kind of a society places on empirical science. And this is kind of old news. So that's kind of the piece of theory that people should know. And there's other more complex ways of deciding whether a science is rigorous, but I think people can understand that those are two distinct things.
Yeah. And so I'm going to share maybe a little bit about my experience of listening to this conversation. And you know, for those who are haven't heard the conversation between Sam Harris and Ezra Klein, I think it's actually well worth listening to as somebody who cares about this kind of identity politics conversation that's happening in our country. I think it's a fascinating conversation, not because of what the outcome was, but because of what the impact on me as an observer was and what I think there is to learn from the way that they had that conversation. And so my experience was really that they never connected. You know, they never really met, and yet they did it with such a level of, disidentification or equipoise that it never became a kind of out and out brawl that these conversations often become. You know, it wasn't like totally ad hominem or, so they sustained this kind of slow simmer of never meeting for like an hour and a half, which ended up being quite frustrating on one level. But again, I think there's a lot we can make of it as an observer. And so I guess, first of all, like, what did you make of the conversation, Bonita? And then maybe we can talk a little bit about, you know, in an ideal world, how would we have this conversation a bit differently? But first, what did you make of it as you listened to it?
Yeah, I think like yourself, I felt fortunate and really grateful that people are having these kinds of attempts at conversation, because it acts like a fishbowl. We can sit back and say, oh, I've been there. Now, let me be an observer and try to figure out what it is that gets us when we're in these kinds of non-conversations. So I think part of it was just design problem. They started out by explaining to the audience what had happened, which was required. But then they never stopped and said, now let's get on a different stage. So I think part of it was because they were seduced by having to tell the backstory just to get started. So that might be something for people to remember. Once you do that, then say, okay, boom, let's get on this other stage. Right? So that's one thing I noticed. But the other thing was that they were really having two different conversations. Harris was having a conversation he has often, and that is that there should be free speech around good ideas or good science. And Klein, and what, as far as I could see, was very much interested in talking about individual motivation and the social consequences of ideas. So if they could have said that, okay, so this is where we're at. There's two questions going on here. For Harris, the question is it good science? And for Klein, Harris would ask, you know, should good science be somehow regulated by society or culture or non-scientific processes? And then they could have participated in those two explorations. That's one way it could have moved.
And what would that have like looked like in that conversation? If that question makes sense, and if it doesn't, I can rephrase it.
Well, I think the first part, is it good science, that, you know, you would ask of Harris, Klein could have said, but I agree with you, Sam, that if it's good science, it should be allowed in the public conversation without any blowback or pushback, right? I mean, that was, or bullying. But Harris, Sam, is it good science? And then we could look at these things like control. Is it robust and rigorous enough? What's the test for a complex problem like this? Empirical science is not proven to be able to get at. It's not a sufficient methodology for complex nonlinear complex dynamics. Empiricism can't get at it. You have to use a different science. So Sam Harris might have had more to say about that, and that could have gone on, but I think that's where I would have thought it would have gone.
Right. And so one of the pieces that you mentioned to me in both the Jordan Peterson and Ezra Klein vis-a-vis Sam Harris conversations is you identified what you called the fault lines in the conversation, which seems like that might be a kind of tactic or move that feels really relevant, just to, again, place us in a context. You know, those of us who care about creating a better planet will need to learn to have conversations across paradigms, across developmental stages, across perspectives, whatever you want to call it. And it sounds like the sort of identifying and naming of the fault line is perhaps a key strategy in having those conversations well.
Yeah. So the other question, the fault line that, or the more interesting question is what Harris could have posed to Klein. And that is, should good science, okay, so let's say Sam Harris says, okay, I agree. It's not a good example because it's not really good science, but should good science be regulated or otherwise adjudicated or evaluated by society and culture through methods that are not scientific, right? So that's an interesting question. And you know, it's probably not profitable to just to say, yes, of course, you know, because then you'd say, well, you know, let's just call something valid if it appeals to us, our in-group and we don't want to do that. So that I think would be a good question to pursue.
And so, and that again is a kind of question at the fault line, right?
Yeah.
And so what, I guess to take on a different perspective. So let's say we people who are hearing you talk about these things find ourselves in a conversation with somebody operating out of a different paradigm, or we're hearing a conversation between paradigms in which people are, the fault line's not being identified. They're not really meeting. How do we cultivate a kind of how do we cultivate the capacity to identify and then speak on behalf of fault lines in a way that actually can transform conversations and make them more skillful?
Yeah, so I think that's a really good question. That's what can we actually practice? I think the first practice is you have to understand that the person that is speaking on the other side of you is communicating something that is whole for them. You know, that unless they're being dishonest, I don't think either of them, you don't get the sense that people are being strategizing or dishonest, but that people are really trying, that they're really looking around. You can see by their body language or their tone that they're looking around and they just can't continually don't see an out. I mean, I feel that with Sam Harris. He kind of keeps looking around and he just doesn't see an out. So then I need to be able to understand what it feels like to be thinking from that point of view, because there's a lot of truths in that point of view. So can I just pick out what is true from that point of view and then either show that it's inconsistent or incomplete, right? So, and then the other person then, of course, has to do the same for the other side. And that's what Bhaskar called explanatory critique. You get inside their explanation. But to do that, you really have to be in good faith also. You have to trust that they are looking from a whole perspective. And I think when Klein suggested that Sam Harris get to know other, you know, people who are rigorous thinkers, people of other people of color, other group identity, I think this was something he was intuiting, that Sam didn't have a lot of insight into someone who could stand in front of him and really speak from their whole experience and yet be not consistent with what Sam was saying. So that's kind of a both an intellectual and an empathic skill.
Yeah, yeah. It really strikes me as the kind of skillful weaving together of, like, you know, not really these terms, but IQ and EQ, you know, this our ability to leverage both of those capacities together in order to really get somebody's world and then, like, look at it from their perspective, mm-hmm. right? You say that your motivation has to be almost towards improving the perspective of the person you're in conversation with. Which is fascinating. Like, it's a fascinating kind of prompt that I've actually been using since you wrote that to me in, like, a Facebook message, and just in conversations, it's fascinating to really take a moment and just consider the conversation from the other person's perspective, like imagining the other person's perspective, almost to practice that. And I'm like, is that how you use it, or how do you tend to use that kind of approach?
Yeah. So when you listen to people talking, you kind of pretend it's your own thought process, like someone's talking in your head. What would I be like if this is the kind of conversation that was going on in my head? You know, you can actually, that's a little practice that I've done in groups. There's many times that I've done this practice with other people who were doing the same practice, and we understood that one or both of us would say, I hear you, but I can't get into it. You know, you just know that you can't, it's not an intellectual thing. Somehow you're just not embodying that whole perspective, that their experience comes to them as a whole. We can help them step out of the experience and see, oh, here's where it's inconsistent, or here's where you've drawn a harsh cut and you need to let more information in. But you can't really know where to go unless you can step in to that. Yeah. And you can't always do it, but then you don't persist in these cyclical conversations that don't go anywhere. You just continue to try to open into the other person's reality world.
Yeah. I mean, it brings to mind for me the kind of, I don't know, are you familiar with, like, the practice of circling?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, where it's, you know, the purpose of circling, at least that's what they say, is to get the other person's world.
Yeah.
And so there's an element of that there, perhaps, in terms of what capacities circling might afford us if it's perhaps kind of woven together with this sort of intellectual cognitive capacity for sort of seeing more clearly somebody's perspective in that way. Do you think that's true, or what's your sense of that?
Yeah, because I think circling's trying to integrate, you know, the embodied aspect, the embodied skill that is required for this capacity. It's not just about being intellectual enough to understand the other person. There's subtle contexts that are not getting in there. I could tell you a cool story that So I ran a landscape design build architecture firm for many years. And there was this one designer, and she was very energetic, very talented, but she had become a designer from the ground up. She started when she was 14 years old, pushing a wheelbarrow as a landscape crew. And so she wasn't academic or intellectually sophisticated in a certain way, but she was very intuitive and very curious about people and nature. But she would come, and we'd have these arguments over what we should do on some big project or scheduling. And we kind of go at it, you know, it's business and it's a lot of pressure and time frames. And I would always win. didn't matter. And because I was a much more sophisticated thinker, as she would trump my argument, then I would just make it more complex. And then she would, but I was a much more complex thinker, and she would just shake her head and go out. And it didn't get nasty. But one day I was in the middle of a similar kind of thing, and she was saying her piece and I was saying my piece, and then it was doing the same thing. And then I won. But right as I won, I realized she was right, because I switched context. Like, I had this embodied experience of the context in which she was arguing from. And she still walked out of the room and thought I was right. But that taught me a lesson. Like, just because you can win the argument doesn't mean you're right. And I tried to study, gee, what just happened there? Like, what just happened there? This was a very big experience for me.
Wonderful. And how have you found a way subsequently to kind of, in your own experience, cause that to arise, that kind of grokking of the other person's experience? Like, do you have any ways into that you've found that work for you?
It's got to be just what we said before, that this person is right in their context, and I need to be curious about, can I help expand or deepen the context, not be right from a different context.
Yeah, it strikes me like I lived in a monastery for a little bit, and the teacher there would always say that the reason why the world is so messed up is because people are unwilling to put down their own perspectives.
Yeah. And you can't always enter into another person's perspective. That would be really arrogant. You know, I can only know so much about some other person's experience, and certainly very little about others, but to be curious about their experience is helpful on both sides of the equation.
Right. And that's always possible.
Yes.
It's always possible to access that curiosity.
Right.
Interesting. So one piece, I guess I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on. So I listened to and then we'll get on to the Jordan Peterson aspect of it, and the kind of more meta theoretical piece, because I think that's really relevant here too. But in the Ezra Klein, Sam Harris conversation, you know, one of the things that Ezra Klein said at one point was essentially, you think you can access a perspective outside of identity, but I don't see you as being able to do that. To which Sam Harris replied, you know, I can. It's actually you who can't essentially leave the perspective of your identity. And, you know, what that made me think of is like, well, Sam Harris is a pretty hardcore meditator. You know, he has a way to kind of exit his particular identity and has access to a bigger perspective. What's the relevance of that in these kinds of conversations? Like, how should we think about that whole piece?
Well, that's a big question. So Sam Harris is a little bit of a puzzle, because he has apparently had experiences of getting out of identity, relative identities, roles, narratives, autobiographical self. But his mind is so completely identified with the scientific method, it's almost like a bait and switch. If you're a sophisticated meditator, you will be able to see that, for example, Sam Harris can see that religion is inside a culture. The culture is not inside a religion, right? So that's a modern critique of religion. But science is inside a culture the same way, and he can't see that. So he's actually inside a kind of identity that is not the same kind of category that Klein is talking about. But so that's a distinction. And so that's that's why, you know, so Sam Harris is trying to say, you can get out of that. It's not, it's relative. It's not absolute. But, you know, I think the, and then maybe this is a segue into Peterson, the idea of identity politics, I think is a very complex question. And I think Peterson, kind of dances with the question a little better than Harris.
Yeah. And it's funny, even just in talking to you, I'm realizing that I have a tendency to kind of want to reduce these types of conversations to like perspective taking that people do or do not have access to. And so in my own way, you know, I'm doing that reductive movement. Whereas I might, you know, the conversation itself might be better served by instead really trying to more deeply understand the motivations and just the whole perspective of those who are arguing from the, you know, in my case, from the perspective of like an identity politics lens.
Yeah. So identity politics is, we can go into this in many different ways. One of them just popped up, so I'll just throw it out there. So there is a sense in which people, to really be fully enlightened or liberated or free, they need to be sovereign. That's the term Jordan Greenhalgh uses. Mm-hmm. They need to be self-determined. You want your own experience to create the context in which you act. So this is not, so that's the I, that's the self-agentic I, the sovereign I, the sovereignty of the individual, the individuated, fully individuated participant is an agent. Now, George Herbert Mead, who was an American pragmatist, he showed how people have both an I, that's their authentic actor, and then a me, that's them thinking about themselves from the perspective of the other, so your social self. And the me is a complicated and disempowering aspect of your psyche, because you're basically not self-authoring. You're not self-agentic. You're always posturing. And so identity politics, in my opinion, is problematized because it's a me and not an I. Right? So if I first think of myself as white or black or Western or woman, that doesn't come up in my experience. That comes up in the way society categorizes me. And it's a, it's a chain, right? It's an unfreedom. So identity politics is a disempowering. And this is why I said that, you know, the people on the other side, the more trans conventional can look like they're reductive, because they argue against identity politics, and so they can see the complexity but also see that perhaps this is very problematic. So you see things like in the origination of the psyche and the self. What the me is very important aspect. And so if I take on a racial identity and someone tells me I'm oppressed, and this is part of a big part of my identity, then I am going to actually self-fulfill those beliefs. And it's very disempowering. Mm-hmm. So this is the more sophisticated the concepts get, people just hook on the concepts and become very disempowered with that kind of discourse.
Yeah. And, you know, so you don't know this about me, but I organized with Occupy Wall Street, you know, when that was happening in Zuccotti Park. And during that time, I remember being very kind of embedded in that worldview, or at least kind of attempting to reconcile it. I have subsequently sort of, I think, you know, as you say, problematized it, and have attempted to express what I see now to people who are still in that worldview. And it's incredibly difficult, to the point where I've just stopped, because when I attempt to open up space for a critical conversation, you know, ad hominem start flying, I get called, you know, a racist, a misogynist, all of these pieces that, you know, in public spaces, if you're called that, and it gets at, you know, even having this conversation on the internet, you know, now it's going to be part of the Google record, and it's dangerous to have those conversations. And yet, as a culture, I feel like we need to learn to have those conversations in a way that really does reveal the nuance and this, you know, the kind of points that you're bringing up. And it's tricky. It's very tricky. And I just wonder, after I say all that, if there's anything that's coming to your mind about how we might have those conversations better.
So I think it's tricky when you're having the conversation in aboutism. Like, so we're talking about identity politics, and we could talk about people who do this or the Me Too movements or whatever. I think it's much easier in real life. I think people actually have good instincts of how to talk to other people, that they have no, you know, they didn't know, if they took it for granted that what social media said, they probably would think, oh, I could never have a conversation with that type of person. And then you sit down and you find, oh, wow, I have a good instinct to talk to people. And so it's don't spend so much time in aboutism, but try to remember that we have the faculty to meet people and instincts to have a conversation.
Yeah.
And that's people who are, you know, ordinary people.
And yeah. Yeah. And it strikes me, yeah, well, it's just what, in what you're saying, that it's not so much that we need to learn to have a better conversation about identity politics, but that we need to learn to have a better conversation, period, like with each other in a kind of just more human basic way.
Correct.
And that will sort of take care of itself along the way of rediscovering our shared humanity.
Exactly. So if I meet someone and I believe I have to understand identity politics in order to take a first step, we'll get stuck in aboutism. And as you said, even it's very tricky how to language that without sounding either like a racist or whatever, or the opposite of a racist, someone who's going over, you know, overcompensating.
Mm-hmm.
So, but if I just sit down and try to talk to someone using the skills I have as a human being, it tends to be actually much more productive.
Mm-hmm. You know? Totally. Totally.
That's, yeah. We forget that. And so part of this big conversation around identity politics adds kind of fuel to the fire, and it's probably working in the wrong direction, and it, in, you know, it has to work itself out in the collective imagination and the battlegrounds of ideas. But as an individual, you don't have to like jump on that boat.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. And I think that we do need to respond to this somehow as a, on a systemic level. Like we need to figure out ways that we can expose each other to other human beings who represent different perspectives or identities to us, you know, in a regular way, because the kind of echo chamber or isolation that's happening partially as a result of digital technologies, it seems like we need to come up with something to break that cycle. But I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. We don't have to spend any more time on that. I just wanted to place that in there too.
Yeah, I think that we need to have a lot more insight into ourselves and understand where we feel threatened, why we feel threatened, why don't we get to a place of trust, and you know, the whole conversation, there should be as many conversations around that as there are around these hot topics and to really understand ourselves. You know, why is it that when I used to live in the city and ride the subway all the time and it was fun. And now I live in rural Connecticut for many years, and I was on the subway in the city a few couple of years ago, and I was like uptight. And I'm like, why am I uptight? It's because it's all unfamiliar territory to me, you know, and just to understand our own reactions that are normal and not draw a linear line between this reaction and that person is to blame. You know, the humans are not linear. They're not governed by linear causality. There's a lot more going on.
Right.
So I don't know how to take on identity politics in an about, you know, if you sit down and talk about it, I don't seem
right.
Hope in it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And what I hear you are saying is really, it's much more that it's a symptom of a general dehumanization of the other in our country that has led to the and the way in is really in that way, like probably like having dinners with people in your community that you don't normally talk to. Like
yeah.
That's more, if we do that, that's more how we'll start to resolve these. And okay. So I'm glad that we talked about that, because I think it's one, it's hard to have good conversations about identity politics in media. And I think maybe we just did. We'll see in the responses we get to the podcast. But in any case, I feel good about it right now. I do want to turn towards, again, what we brought up at the kind of the beginning of this conversation around the simplicity on the other side of complexity, or the movement to release complexity. And you brought this up with regards to the Jordan Peterson, Sam Harris conversation. And we can use that as an example, but it's a different kind of situation. And specifically, it seems like it's when different meta-theoretical positions sort of encounter each other in conversation. Is that how you would sort of set it up?
Yes. And how
okay. Yeah.
They gain how people gain confidence by the way meta theory works, but it's also where the problem is.
Right, right. So people become confident in a meta theoretical position because they can stand up and like see everything and put it in its kind of subsume it into their grander perspective.
Yes.
But then we have, in the case of Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris, two people who are holding meta-theoretical perspectives. They meet and not...
Yeah, they both gain confidence.
Right, they both gain confidence.
Yeah. Yes. Whereas at least when you're doing theories, you know, one starts to become much stronger than the other, right? But in this meta theory, they're both gaining confidence. This is the tricky part of meta theory, is this lived experience of gaining confidence.
Interesting. Interesting.
That's an embodied experience. So it's hard to get at with the mind, right? Because that's what's happening, right? It reminds me of I had this German shepherd, and he would go out, you know, we live in the country, and he'd go out and he'd chase porcupines, and then he'd come back, you know, and we'd take him to the vet, and he'd have all these quills in him, and he'd gain more confidence. Just, you know, he's going to go out right. And really get them this time, you know, it's kind of right. Like, you know, biting into a porcupine.
Right, right, right. Okay. And so, as we talked about before, one response to that is create a new meta theory that attempts to kind of submerge both of the meta theories or all of the meta theories that are encountering each other, you know, raising the complexity bar. Right. But then the other response, which I want to really dive into with you for a little bit, is this movement of releasing complexity.
Right.
And so let's take, again, this conversation of Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris. They both walked away from that conversation more certain that their perspective was right. Like it for both of them, my sense of it was like, oh, like this person doesn't get it. I understand where they're coming from, but they don't get it. I have a bigger picture. Yay me.
Yeah.
Right. So that's obviously not ideal. Like that's not a productive conversation, really. What if they were able to access this movement of releasing complexity? What might have happened in their meeting?
Well, first of all, if they could understand or abide by this property that we just articulated very simply, that you gain confidence because you can see each other's, but that's happening on both sides, that should immediately put them in a different place to have their conversation, right? That one move, if they understood it and they accepted it or were curious about it, is itself a, you know, you enter a new starting position by understanding that. So I think just that one move is powerful. In terms of, and then they could perhaps see that in this mutuality, there's actually something, another idea that wants to emerge. It's something that neither of them have thought of. You know, there's this person who wrote a lot of patents for Google. I think his name is Tim Chu. I'm not sure, but he said, you know, when you bring experts to solve a problem, you don't want them tossing around what they know, because if the problem could be solved by what anybody already knows, it would be solved. Right. So these things, they don't sound like very sophisticated, you know, rules or protocols, but they're very powerful protocols. And the thing is, we need to discipline ourselves to control that. You know, don't try to solve this problem by things I already know. It's not going to work. Can we enter in? So it's kind of like painting. You know, you see these people who do this painting and they throw all this sand up and actually they're not painting. And then they flip the canvas over and you can see what they were drawing, but they didn't paint the image. They painted the background, right? So another thing that I teach and when I help people process this level of complexity is, so what you do know is everything you know is the boundary of the question, right? So we have sorted out some of the picture because those are the things that are not cue, you know, we need cues, new cues in the environment. So at least we have negated a sufficient amount of ideas. And then, so you can start to tease people. You know, I'm not going to sit here and give you an answer because they're trying to work out something that we as a society are still working out. But we need a different technique or different protocols for conversation,
right,
that can ignite new ideas and not just cycle the same reactive conversations over and over again.
And what comes to mind is things like Theory U. I don't know if you're familiar with Theory U or other kinds of sort of conversational processes that are meant to access, you know, that are meant to take us beyond our individual perspectives into something more emergent. There is that resource. A question that arises for me, though, is that in the context of the realm of like public intellectuals, right, there's this whole a whole another dynamic of like being in that space in public, right? Because it's much safer for Jordan and Sam, Jordan Harris, or Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris to hold fast to their perspectives and not risk what might happen if they venture into the unknown together. And yet, right, like there's so many people paying attention to them talk and sort of like constellating their own identities and own worldview around their meeting and their perspectives. And so like, how fruitful would it be if they could, in a public way, dip into this kind of simplified space or this decrease in complexity or whatever it is? And yeah,
I don't want to detract from the fact that I think both Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson and many other people on the circuit are doing they're doing a good service. They're igniting conversations. There is a need for people to witness at least this level of conversation going on so that people can start saying. A lot of people really like to follow Jordan Peterson, but I know a lot of people are saying, what is it that's resonating with me? And is he a complex thinker? So it allows us to really study this. And then there's always the question of whether or not they're at the part of their career where they're performing more than learning, or, you know, that there's a niche. So I don't know anything about them outside of their performances in public space. So that's always an interesting, I just wanted to throw those out. But I think there is, and people, you know, Jordan Peterson's really good at letting us know he's still trying to work things out himself. But I think there are offline, there are certainly robust conversations going on in different planes. Whether or not that ever reaches the public scene, I think we start to see a little bit of it. But people working at that level are trying to use language in a way that it neither triggers reactive responses, nor so complex and nuanced that people can't understand it. So a lot of people are trying to wrap their heads around this and create a sophisticated insight in sort of simpler language. I think that's what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, I don't mean in the way that we're talking about Jordan Peterson or anybody we've talked about to at all take away from them, who I see all of these people we've talked about as performing beautiful services to our culture in terms of demonstrating what it's like to articulate perspectives in a beautiful and intelligent and welcoming way to invite people into more complexity and, passion about learning and all of, I mean, it's so good. And their conversations are demonstrating to me the need for us to have models of this other kind of almost kind of mind that we're talking about here, that's able to play in this space of emergence. And I know that it exists in the world because I see it often, but I don't see it being performed publicly. And that seems like the particular need that I'm sensing into. And there are particular risks there.
Yeah, so that's the risk factor is, I think, a big factor. I think that at the stage most people are working with, it's still rather theoretical. And so when it comes down to addressing, let's say, everything I talked about, this new mind, or we talked about this new approach, or theory U, or I do a version of collective practice called collective insight practice. It's a lot of it is quite theoretical. We're trying to figure out the foundations of how to be better thinkers. And then if you throw in that into that process, something like the Me Too movement, you'll find that it gets hyper complex really fast because of the complexity of our own experience and triggers and beliefs and loyalties. And so the ability to both discipline your mind and be a human being and try to process something that may or may not trigger you or the group is, it's very high risk, even if it's in private space. I mean, but it's good clean work if you really want to do it.
Yeah. And I think maybe one the place to kind of end the or move towards the end of the conversation is something that you mentioned before we started recording, which pricked my ears, which is that you're noticing that this kind of new mind, we might call it for now, for lack of a better word, seems to be more accessible to the youngest people that you know, or the young generations. And I wonder if you could tell me a little bit more about that experience that you're having.
It just seems to me that I think the whole postmodern identity politics, a lot of that is probably peaking. You know, a lot of these things, when feels like it's at its height and it's most critical and it's going to destroy the world as we know it, it's usually when these are already on the way out. Mm-hmm. And so there are a lot of young people who've gone to school and have not been inundated so much with those values or, you know, that way of thinking about the world. And I mean, it basically we're looking at post-structuralism and more sense of individual agency, you know, the maker movement, for example. And it's off the grid because it's not it's not mainstream. And so I think that, and that's one of the little beefs I would have with Jordan Peterson. These types of things, if you add fire to them, then you actually prolong them. Mm. And I think, you know, he has to ask himself a question. When is it time? I planted the seed, I created the momentum. What am I going to do now?
Yeah.
Like you want to be, you want people like him to be at the edge of things. And that means throwing away everything that he's known and search for why that was a limiting container. Why was that limiting?
Yes.
And if more people did that, then I think we would get to where we're the simpler side of things. We would push through this hyper complexity and be able to start solving problems that we can't really wrap our heads around. So mm-hmm. something like that.
Yeah. And I'm on my side, I'm tracking, things like the meta modern movement, the movement of thinkers identifying as meta modernism. So it sounds like you're familiar with that too. So, and there are people in that movement who are really like lobbing things at Jordan Peterson, getting him to basically ask him to say like, hey, like, look what we're doing. Don't you think it would be cool if you adopted some of this perspective taking that we're playing with? And so I am really interested too in what it would be like if somebody like Jordan Peterson or Sam Harris perhaps, or some other public intellectual really stepped more fully into this kind of new mind perspective and what that would do. I mean, that's a whole nother conversation. The other piece I wanted to name is around this emerging generation and their kind of natural proficiency with this new mind is that's something that Jordan Greenhall has spoken about, in particular, noticing how they collaborate in spaces like Minecraft, right? And their ability to kind of just, in an emergent, non-structured way, collaborate and build things that no individual could build. And even just talking about it, like it's making my skin kind of tingle because in a lot of ways, you know, I'm 31 and I think of my life now as being, hopefully I will create the mechanisms by which we can redistribute power away from the people who are on their way out and into the hands of this emerging generation so that they can actually like make good on the minds that they have had structured for them. And like there's so much potential there, I think, for a new world to emerge much more quickly than anybody might guess.
Yeah. And in those places, everyone's invited.
Yes.
Everybody's invited in.
Yeah. Right on.
You know, most of my work is right now in reinventing organizations. You know, I have open participatory organization and self-organization and how to release complexity in organizational life and how to think of humans as evolved to be really good at self-organizing. And I think that's what Jordan Greenhalgh, I think he used the story of his daughters and her classmates. And they don't think, oh, we need an organization. We need just to know how to get together.
Yes.
And participate. And I think that all of that is what is beyond, it's on the other side of identity politics and just so listeners know, there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Yeah, we'll end it there, and maybe just kind of bookmark it if we want to have another conversation. I would love to talk to you about the kind of I agree with you. I think participation is the bridge. That is the central piece of the emerging paradigm. Is how do we create contexts in which everybody can participate? And there's something so beautiful there for me.
Yeah. And, in my work, it's always the same question. What are you participating with? And that's, we can end there, and it's also beginning, because in the ending is, what is Sam Harris participating with when he's having this conversation?
Mm.
What set of biases and limiting beliefs and this and that? And Jordan Peterson or anyone, what am I participating with when I'm doing identity politics? So participating with thoughts that somebody put in my head, and so that question is very powerful when you do group process.
Mm. And so we can go meta in this moment and ask you, listener, what are you participating in this conversation with? What are you bringing here?
Exactly.
Yeah.
As you listen to this, watch what comes up. What's happening in your experience? And some of that you might want to amplify, and some of it you might want to dissolve or disperse.
Yeah. And if you do want to amplify some of what you're participating with, feel free to reach out to the show. So if you do use Anchor, which is one of the platforms that we use, you can call in and leave a message, and we would post it on an episode, and you can participate in this conversation. I think that's
great.
Exactly what we need to do is participate.
Everyone's
in multidimensionality,
invited.
So, well, thank you very much, yes. Bonita. I so appreciate your willingness to have this conversation. Yeah.
Thank you very much. And good luck. I think you're traveling. So good luck and have fun. Bye-bye.